"For God's sake!"
But the louder he spoke, the lower she drooped her once proud, bright, but now dishonored head, and she writhed, slipping down from the sofa on which she sat to the floor at his feet. She would have fallen on the carpet if he had not held her.
"My God, forgive me!"
she said, sobbing and pressing Vronsky's hand to her breast. She felt so guilty, so much to blame, that it only remained for her to humble herself and ask to be forgiven. But she had no one in the world now except him, so that even her prayer for forgiveness was addressed to him. Looking at him, she felt her degradation physically and could say nothing more. He felt what a murderer must feel when looking at the body he has deprived of life. The body he had deprived of life was their love, the first period of their love. There was something frightful and revolting in the recollection of what had been paid for with this terrible price of shame. The shame she felt at her spiritual nakedness communicated itself to him. But in spite of the murderer's horror of the body of his victim, that body must be cut in pieces and hidden away, and he must make use of what he has obtained by the murder. Then, as the murderer desperately throws himself on the body, as though with passion, and drags it and hacks it, so Vronsky covered her face and shoulders with kisses. She held his hand and did not move. Yes, these kisses were what had been bought by their shame.
"Yes, and this hand, which will always be mine, is the hand of my accomplice."
She lifted his hand and kissed it. He knelt down and tried to see her face, but she hid it and did not speak. At last, as though mastering herself, she sat up and pushed him away. Her face was as beautiful as ever, but all the more piteous.
"It's all over," she said. "I have nothing but you left. Remember that."
"I cannot help remembering what is life itself to me. For one moment of that bliss..."
"What bliss?" she said, with disgust and horror, and the horror was involuntarily communicated to him.
"For heaven's sake, not another word!"
She rose quickly and moved away from him.
"Not another word," she repeated,
and with a look of cold despair, strange to him, she left him. She felt that at that moment she could not express in words her feeling of shame, joy, and horror at this entrance on a new life, and she did not wish to vulgarize that feeling by inadequate words. Later on, the next day and the next, she still could not find words to describe all the complexity of those feelings, and could not even find thoughts with which to reflect on all that was in her soul. She said to herself,
"No, I can't think about it now. Later, when I am calmer."
But that calm, necessary for reflection, never came. Every time the thought of what she had done, and of what was to become of her, and of what she should do, came to her mind, she was seized with horror and drove these thoughts away.
"Not now, later, when I am calmer," she said to herself.
But in her dreams, when she had no control over her thoughts, her position appeared to her in all its shocking nakedness. One dream she had almost every night. She dreamt that both at once were her husbands and lavished their caresses on her. Alexei Alexandrovich wept, kissing her hand, saying, "How beautiful it is now!" And Alexei Vronsky was there too, and he also was her husband. And she was surprised that formerly this had seemed impossible to her, and laughingly explained to them how much simpler it really was, and that they were both now contented and happy. But this dream weighed on her like a nightmare, and she woke from it filled with horror.
Chapter 12
When Lievin first returned from Moscow, and while he still started and blushed every time he remembered the disgrace of the refusal, he had said to himself, "I blushed and started like this when I was ploughed in physics and had to remain in the second class. And in the same way I felt myself lost when I made a mess of my sister's affair that had been entrusted to me. And what happened? Now that years have passed, when I remember it, I am surprised that it could have grieved me so much. So it will be with this grief. Time will pass, and I shall become indifferent." But 3 months passed, and he had not become indifferent to it, and to think of it still hurt him as it had done in the first days. He could not find peace, because he had so long dreamt of family life and felt so ripe for it, but was still unmarried and further than ever from marriage. He himself felt painfully what all those around him felt too, that it is not good for a man of his age to be alone. He remembered how, just before leaving for Moscow, he had said to Nikolai, his cowman, a naive peasant with whom he liked to talk, "Well, Nikolai, I want to get married," and how Nikolai had promptly replied, as on a matter about which there could be no doubt, "And it's high time, Konstantin Dmitrich." But now he was further from marriage than ever. The place was unoccupied, and when in imagination he tried to put one of the girls he knew there, he felt that it was quite impossible. Moreover, the memory of her refusal and the part he had played in it tormented him with shame. However much he told himself that he was not at all to blame in that matter, the memory of it, together with other shameful memories, made him start and blush. There had been in his past, as in that of every man, actions which he realized were bad and for which his conscience ought to have tormented him. But the recollections of those bad actions did not torment him nearly as much as these trivial yet shameful memories. These wounds never closed up. And among these recollections stood the memory of her refusal and the pitiful role he must have played in the eyes of the others that evening. But time and work told. The painful memories became more and more covered over by the commonplace but important events of country life. Every week he thought less and less about Kitty. He waited impatiently to hear that she was married or was getting married soon, hoping that such news, like the drawing of an aching tooth, would quite cure him. Meanwhile, spring had come, a glorious, steady spring, without the expectations and disappointments spring usually brings. It was one of these rare springs which plants, animals, and men alike rejoice in. This lovely spring roused Levin still more and confirmed him in the determination completely to renounce the past in order to fashion his solitary life firmly and independently. Though he had not carried out many of the plans with which he had returned to the country from Moscow, he had held to the most important one, that of living a pure life, and he was not experiencing the shame which used to torment him when he had fallen, but was able to look people boldly in the face. Already in February he had received a letter from Maria Nikolaevna to say that his brother Nikolai's health was getting worse, but that he would not submit to any treatment. In consequence of this news, Lievin went to Moscow, saw his brother, and managed to persuade him to consult a doctor and go to a watering place abroad. He was so successful in persuading his brother and in lending him money for the journey without irritating him that he was satisfied with himself in this respect. Besides his agricultural pursuits, which required special attention in spring, and besides reading, Lievin had another occupation. He had that winter begun writing a book on agriculture, the basis of which was that the character of the labourer was treated as a definite factor, like climate and soil, and that therefore the conclusions of agricultural science should be deduced not from data supplied by climate and soil only, but from data of climate, soil, and the immutable character of the labourer. So that in spite of his solitary life, or rather because of it, his time was completely filled up. Only occasionally he felt an unsatisfied desire to share with someone besides Agafya Mikhailovna the thoughts that wandered through his brain. for even with her he often discussed physics, agricultural theories, and especially philosophy, which last was her favourite subject. The spring had set in late. During the last weeks of Lent, the weather had been clear and frosty. It thawed in the sunshine by day, but at night the thermometer went down to 16 degrees Fahrenheit. The snow was covered with a crust of ice so thick that carts could pass even where there were no roads. Easter found snow still on the ground, but on Easter Monday a warm wind began to blow, the clouds gathered, and for 3 days and nights warm, stormy rain poured down. On the Thursday the wind fell, and a thick grey mist rose as if to hide the secret of the changes nature was carrying on. Beneath the mist, the snow waters rushed down, the ice on the river cracked and moved, and the turbid, foaming torrents flowed quicker, till on the first Sunday after Easter, towards evening, the mists dissolved, the clouds broke into fleecy cloudlets and dispersed, the sky cleared, and real spring was there. In the morning, the bright rising sun quickly melted the thin ice on the water, and the warm air all around vibrated with the vapour given off by the awakening earth. Last year's grass grew green again, and new blades came up like needle points. Buds swelled on the guelder rose and currant bushes and on the sticky, spicy birch trees, and among the golden catkins and on the willow branches the bees began to hum. The unseen larks burst into song above the velvety fresh green and the frozen stubble. The peewits began to cry above the water brought down by the storm and still flooding the low-lying places and marshes. And high up the cranes and geese flew uttering their spring call. The cattle, who had lost all but a few patches of their winter coats, began to low in the meadows. The crooked-legged lambs began to play round their bleating mothers who were losing their wool. Swift-footed children began to run along the quickly drying paths marked with imprints of bare feet. The merry voices of women who were bleaching their linen began to chatter by the ponds, and the axes of peasants, getting ready their wooden ploughs and harrows, clicked in the yards. The real spring had come. Chapter 13. Lievin put on his high boots, and for the first time a cloth coat instead of a fur, and went out to attend to his farm. Stepping now on a piece of ice, now into the sticky mud, he crossed the stream of dazzling water. Spring is the time for making plans and resolutions, and Lievin, like a tree which in the springtime does not yet know in which direction and what manner its young shoots and twigs, still imprisoned in their buds, will develop, did not quite know what work on his beloved land he was going to take in hand, but he felt that his mind was full of the finest plans and resolutions. First of all he went to the cattle yard. The cows had been let out there, and, warmed by the sunshine, their glossy new coats glistening, they were lowing to be let out into the fields. After he had for a while admired his cows, all familiar to him to the minutest detail, Lievin gave orders for them to be driven into the field and for the calves to be let out into the yard. The cowherd ran away merrily to get ready. The dairymaids, with twigs in their hands, holding their skirts up over their bare white legs, not yet sunburnt, splashed through the puddles into the yard, driving the calves, who were mad with the joy of spring. Having gazed with admiration at the exceptionally fine calves born that year, the older ones were as big as peasants' cows, and Parva's three-month-old calf was as big as a yearling, Lievin gave orders to bring a trough of food for them and to put some hay into the racks outside. But it turned out that the racks, which had been put up in the yard and not used during winter, were broken. He sent for the carpenter, who was under contract to be with the threshing machine, but it turned out that he was mending the harrows, which should have been mended the week before Lent. This was very annoying to Lievin. It was vexing that the careless farm management, against which he had struggled so many years with all his might, still continued. He found out that the racks, which were not wanted in winter, had been taken into the farm horse's stable, and there had got broken, as they were lightly made, being meant only for the calves. Besides this, it proved that the harrows, and all the agricultural implements which he had ordered to be examined and mended in winter, for which purpose three carpenters had been specially engaged, had not been seen to, and the harrows were now being mended when it was time to start harrowing. Lievin sent for the steward, but instead of waiting, went at once to look for him himself. The steward, in his astrakhan-trimmed coat, as radiant as everything else that day, was coming from the threshing-ground, breaking a bit of straw in his hands.
"Why is the carpenter not with the threshing-machine?" "Oh, I meant to tell you yesterday that the harrows need mending. It's time to plough, you know."
"Why wasn't it done in winter?"
"But what do you want with the carpenter?"
"Where are the racks from the calves' yard?"
"I have given orders for them to be put into their places. What is one to do with such people?" said the steward, waving his arm.
"It's not a case of such people, but of such a steward," said Lievin, flaring up. "Tell me what I keep you for," he shouted.
But remembering that this would not help matters, he stopped in the middle of what he was saying and only sighed.
"Well, can we begin sowing?"
he asked after a pause.
"It will be possible beyond Turchino tomorrow or the day after."
"And the clover?"
"I have sent Vasily. He and Mishka are sowing. Only I don't know if they'll get through. It's very sticky."
"How many acres?"
16.
"Why not the lot?"
shouted Lievin. That they were only sowing 16 instead of 50 acres with clover was still more annoying. To grow clover successfully, it was necessary, according to both theory and his own experience, to sow it as early as possible, almost before the snow had finished melting, and Lievin could never get this done.
"There is no one to do it. What are you to do with such people? Three have not come. And now Simeon..."
"Well, then, you should have let the straw wait."
"So I have.
But where are the men?"
"Five are making compote."
He meant compost.
"And four are turning the oats over. They might begin sprouting, Konstantin Dmitrich."
Lievin understood very well that "might begin sprouting" meant that the English seed oats were already spoiling. Here again his orders had not been obeyed.
"Oh, dear, didn't I speak about it long ago in Lent? Oh, don't worry, it'll all be done in good time."
Lievin waved his hand angrily and went to the barn to look at the oats. Then he came back to the stable. The oats were not yet spoiled, but the men were turning them over with shovels, whereas they should have let them run down from the loft. Lievin ordered them to do this, told off two of the men to help sow the clover, and got over his vexation with the foreman. Indeed, the day was so beautiful, one could not long remain angry.
"Ignat!"
he called to the coachman, who, with sleeves rolled up, was washing a carriage at the pump.
"Saddle me."
"Which, sir?"
"Oh, Kolpik."
"Oh, yes, sir."
While the horse was being saddled, Lievin again called the steward, who was hanging about within sight, in order to make it up with him, and began to talk about the spring work that lay before them and his plans for the estate. "Carting manure must be started early so that it should be over before the first hay harvest, and the far field will have to be ploughed continually so as to keep the earth clean. We must hire labour for the hay harvest and not pay in kind." The foreman listened attentively and evidently tried to approve of his master's plans, but his face still wore that hopeless and despondent expression so familiar to Lievin. This expression seemed to say, "That's all very well, but it will be as God wills." Nothing grieved Lievin so much as this manner, but it was a manner common to all the numerous stewards he had employed. They all took up the same attitude toward his plans, and therefore he now no longer grew angry with them, but he was grieved, feeling all the more stimulated to resist this, so to say, elemental force for which he could find no other name but "as God wills," which always obstructed him.
"We'll see if we can manage it," said the steward. Why should you not manage it?
Oh, we must have at least 15 more labourers, but you see, they don't come. Or some came today, but they wanted 70 rubles each for the summer.
Levin was silent. That force was opposing him again. He knew that try as they would, they had never managed to get more than from 37 to 40 labourers at the proper price. 40 could be hired, but never more than 40. Yet all the same, he could not but continue the struggle.
Send to Suri and to Shefirovka if they don't come. We must try and find men.
I'll send right enough, said Vasily Fedorych, the steward, despondently. But the horses, too, are getting weak.
We will buy some more.
But don't I know, he added, laughing, that you always want less of everything and worse. However, this year I will not let you have your way. I'll see to everything myself.
You don't sleep much as it is, I think. It's always pleasanter for us when the master's eye is on us.
Then it's down in the birch valley that they are sowing the clover? I'll ride over and see, said Levin, mounting the little light bay horse, Kolpik, which the coachman had brought.
You won't be able to cross the brook, Konstantin Dmitrich, the coachman called out. Well, then I'll go through the forest.
And Levin rode across the muddy yard and out of the gate into the field at a brisk amble, his fresh little horse snorting at the puddles and pulling at the bridle. If he had felt light-hearted in the cattle and farmyards, he felt still more so in the fields. Gently swayed by the ambling pace of his good little horse, and drinking in the warm smell with the freshness of snow and air in it, he rode through the forest over the crumbling, sinking snow that melted at each footstep, and rejoiced at the sight of each one of his trees, with its swelling buds and the moss reviving on its bark. When he had passed the forest, a vast expanse of velvety green unrolled before him without a single bare spot, and only sprinkled here and there in the hollows with patches of unmelted snow. He was not irritated either by the sight of a peasant's horse and colt treading down the young growth. He told a peasant he met to drive them off, nor by the jeering and stupid answer the peasant Ipat, whom he happened to meet, gave him in reply to his question,
"Well, Ipat, will it soon be time to sow?" "We must plough first, Konstantin Dmitrich," said Ipat.
The further he went, the happier he felt, and all sorts of plans for his estate, each better than the last, presented themselves to him. To plant rows of willows with a southern aspect on all the fields, so that the snow should not remain long under them. To divide the fields, tilling six and keeping three under grass. To build a new cattle yard at the further end of the field. To dig a pond, and to make folds for the cattle for manuring purposes. Then he would have 300 desyatinas of wheat, 100 of potatoes, and 150 of clover, and not a single desyatina exhausted. Dreaming such dreams, carefully guiding his horse so as not to trample down his young growth, he rode up to the labourers who were sowing the clover. The cart with the seed was standing not on the border, but in a field of winter wheat, which was being cut up by the wheels and trampled by the horse's feet. Both the labourers were sitting on the narrow path between the fields, probably sharing a pipe of tobacco. The earth in the cart with which the seeds were mixed was not rubbed fine, but was pressed or frozen into lumps. On seeing the master, the labourer Vasily moved toward the cart, and Mishka began to sow. This was not right, but Levin seldom got angry with the hired men. When Vasily came up, Levin told him to take the cart and horse onto the border.
"It won't matter, sir. The wheat will recover."
"Please, don't argue," said Levin, "but do as you're told."
"Oh, yes, sir," answered Vasily, and took hold of the horse's head. "But the sowing, Konstantin Dmitrich, is getting on first rate," he said, making up to the master. "Only the walking is dreadful. You drag half a hundredweight on your boots."
"And why has not the earth been sifted?" said Levin.
"Oh, but we crumble it up,"
said Vasily, taking a handful and rubbing the earth between his palms. Vasily was not to blame that they had given him unsifted earth, but still it was annoying. Having more than once successfully tested a patent remedy for conquering vexation and making all that seemed wrong right again, Lievin employed it now. He looked at the strides Mishka took dragging the enormous lumps of earth that stuck to his feet, dismounted, took the seed basket from Vasily, and prepared to sow.
"Where did you stop?"
Vasily pointed to a mark with his foot, and Lievin began scattering the seeds and earth as best he could. It was hard walking, and having done a row, Lievin, wet with perspiration, stopped and gave back the basket.
"Mind, sir, and don't scold me for this row when summer comes," said Vasily. "Why?" said Lievin merrily, feeling that his remedy was acting well. "Oh, you'll see when the summer comes. You'll distinguish it. You just look where I sowed last spring, how regularly I scattered it over. Why, Konstantin Dmitrich, I don't think I could try harder if I was working for my own father. I don't like to do things badly myself, and I see that others don't. What's good for the master is good for us, too. When one looks over there, it makes one's heart rejoice," said Vasily, pointing to the field.
"Fine spring, isn't it, Vasily?"
"Oh, it's a spring such as the old men don't remember. I've been home, and my old father also has sown 3 measures of wheat. They say it's caught up the rye."
"And have you been sowing wheat long?"
"Why, it was you who taught us to sow it. The year before last you gave me a bushel of seed yourself. We sowed a quarter of it and sold the rest." "Well, mind and rub the lumps," said Lievin, going up to his horse, "and keep an eye on Mishka. And if the clover comes up well, you shall have 50 kopecks for each desyatina."
"Thank you kindly. We're very grateful to you as it is."
Lievin mounted his horse and rode to the field where clover had been sown the year before, and to another which was deeply ploughed and ready for sowing the spring wheat. The clover was coming on splendidly. It was already reviving and steadily growing green among last year's wheat stubble. The horse sank into the ground up to its pasterns and drew each foot out of the half-thawed earth with a smacking noise. It was quite impossible to ride over the deeply ploughed field. The earth bore only where there was still a little ice. In the thawed furrows the horse's legs sank in above its pasterns. The ploughed land was in excellent condition. It would be possible to harrow and sow it in a couple of days. Everything was beautiful and gay. Lievin rode back by the way that led across the brook, hoping that the water would have gone down, and he did manage to ford the stream, scaring 2 ducks in so doing. There must be some snipe, too, he thought, and just at the turning to his house he met the keeper, who confirmed his supposition. Lievin rode on at a trot, so as to have dinner and get his gun ready for the evening. Chapter 14. As Lievin, in the highest spirits, was nearing the house, he heard the sound of a tinkling bell approaching the main entrance. "Why, that must be someone from the station," he thought. "They would just have had time to get here from the Moscow train. Who is it? Can it be Brother Nikolai? He did say, perhaps I'll go to a watering place, or perhaps I'll come to you." For a moment, he felt frightened and disturbed lest his brother's presence should destroy the happy frame of mind that the spring had aroused in him. But he was ashamed of that feeling, and immediately, as it were, opened out his spiritual arms and with tender joy expected and now hoped with his whole soul that it was his brother. He touched up his horse and, having passed the acacia trees, saw a hired 3-horse sledge coming from the station and in it a gentleman in a fur coat. It was not his brother. "Oh, if only it's some nice fellow with whom one can have a talk," he thought. "Ah!" he cried joyfully, lifting both arms.
"Here's a welcome guest! Well, I am glad to see you,"
he exclaimed, recognizing Oblonsky. "I shall know now for certain whether she is married, or when she will be," thought Lievin. And on this lovely day he felt that the memory of her did not hurt him at all.
"You did not expect me, eh?"
said Oblonsky, getting out of the sledge with mud on his nose, cheek, and eyebrows, but beaming with cheerfulness and health.
"I have come to see you, that's one thing," he said, embracing and kissing Lievin. "To get some shooting, that's two, and to sell the Ergushevo forest, that's three."
"That's grand! And what a spring we're having! How did you manage to get here in a sledge?"
"It would have been worse still on wheels, Konstantin Dmitrich," said the driver, whom Lievin knew.
"Well, I am very, very glad to see you," said Lievin, with a sincere smile, joyful as a child's. He showed his guest into the spare bedroom, where Oblonsky's things, his bag, a gun in a case, and a satchel with cigars, were also brought, and leaving him to wash and change, Lievin went to the office to give orders about the ploughing and the clover. Agafya Mikhailovna, always much concerned about the honour of the house, met him in the hall with questions about dinner.
"Oh, do just as you please, only be quick," he said, and went out to see the steward.
When he returned, Oblonsky, fresh and clean, with hair brushed and face radiant with smiles, was just coming out of his room, and they went upstairs together.
"How glad I am to have come to you. Now I shall be able to understand what the mysteries you perpetrate here consist of. Oh, but seriously, I envy you. What a house, and everything so splendid, so light, so gay," said Oblonsky,
forgetting that it was not always spring and bright weather there, as on that day.
"And your nurse, quite charming. A pretty housemaid with a little apron would be preferable, but with your severe and monastic style, this one is more suitable."
Oblonsky had much interesting news to tell, and one item of special interest to Lievin was that his brother, Sergei Ivanich, intended to come and stay in the country with him that summer. Not a word did Oblonsky say about Kitty or about any of the Shcherbatskys. He only delivered greetings from his wife. Lievin was grateful to him for his delicacy and was very glad of his visit. As usual during his solitude, a mass of thoughts and feelings he could not express to those around had collected in his mind, and now he poured out to Oblonsky the poetic joy of spring, his failures, his plans concerning the estate, his thoughts and remarks about the books he had read, and especially the idea of his own book, the basis of which, though he did not notice it himself, was a criticism of all previous works on agriculture. Oblonsky, always pleasant and quick at understanding everything from a hint, was specially pleasant on this visit. There was a new trait in him which Lievin noticed and was flattered by, a kind of respect and a sort of tenderness toward him. The efforts of Agafya Mikhailovna and the cook to make the dinner specially nice resulted only in both the hungry friends sitting down to a snack and having to appease their hunger with hors d'oeuvres of bread and butter, smoked goose, and pickled mushrooms, and in Lievin's ordering the soup to be served without waiting for the pasties with which the cook intended to astonish the visitor. But Oblonsky, though used to very different dinners, found everything delicious, the herb beer, the bread and butter, and especially the smoked goose and pickled mushrooms, the nettle soup and the fowl with melted butter sauce, the Crimean white wine, everything was delicious, everything was excellent.
"Splendid, splendid," he said, lighting a thick cigarette after the joint. "I seem to have come to you as one lands from a noisy steamer onto a peaceful shore. So, you maintain that the labourer should be studied as one of the factors which should decide the choice of agricultural methods? You know, I'm quite an outsider in these matters, but I should think this theory and its application ought to influence the labourer, too."
"Yes, but wait a bit. I'm not talking about political economy, but about the science of agriculture. It should resemble the natural sciences and should examine existing phenomena, including the labourer, with his economic and ethnographic..." At that moment, Agafya Mikhailovna came in with some jam.
"Ah, Agafya Mikhailovna," said Oblonsky,
kissing the tips of his plump fingers.
"What smoked goose you have! What herb brandy! But what do you think, Konstantin? Is it not time?" he added.
Lievin glanced out of the window at the sun which was setting behind the bare trees of the forest.
"High time! High time! Kuzma, tell them to harness the trap," he said, and ran downstairs.
Oblonsky went down and himself carefully took the canvas cover off the varnished case, opened it, and set to work to put together his valuable gun, which was of the newest type. Kuzma, already scenting a substantial tip, did not leave Oblonsky for a moment. He put on his stockings and his boots for him, and Oblonsky willingly allowed him to do so.
Konstantin, please leave word that if the dealer Ryabinin comes, I told him to come here today, they should ask him in and let him wait.
Are you selling the forest to Ryabinin?
Yes.
Do you know him?
Of course I know him. I have had dealings with him positively and finally.
Oblonsky laughed. Positively and finally were the dealer's favourite words.
Yes, he does speak very funnily. Hey, she knows where the master is going, he added, patting Laska, who was whining and jumping round Levin, now licking his hand, now his boots and his gun.
The trap was standing at the door when they went out.
"I told them to harness, though it is not far, but if you like, we can walk."
"No, let us drive," said Oblonsky, stepping up into the trap.
He sat down, wrapped a rug round his legs, and lit a cigar.
"How is it you don't smoke?
A cigar is such a... not exactly a pleasure, but the crown and sign of pleasure.
Ah, this is life. How delightful. This is how I should like to live."
"But who prevents you?" Levin remarked, smiling.
"No, you are a lucky fellow. You've got all you are fond of. You like horses, you have them. Hounds, you have them. Shooting, you get it. Farming, you get it too."
"Perhaps it is because I am glad of what I get and don't grieve about what I haven't," said Levin, thinking of Kitty.
Oblonsky understood and looked at him, but said nothing. Levin was grateful to Oblonsky because, with his usual tact, noticing that Levin was afraid of talking about the Shcherbatskys, he avoided mentioning them. But now Levin wanted to find out about the matter that tormented him and yet feared to speak of it.
"Well, and how are your affairs?" he asked, recollecting how wrong it was of him to be thinking only of his own concerns.
Oblonsky's eyes began to glitter merrily.
"But you don't admit that one may want a roll while one gets regular rations. You consider it a crime.
And I don't believe in life without love,"
he answered, understanding Levin's question in his own way.
"How can I help it? I am made that way. And really, so little harm is done to anyone, and one gets so much pleasure."
"Is there anything new, then?" inquired Levin.
"There is. Well, you know Ossian's type of woman, such as one sees in a dream? Well, there are such women in reality, and these women are terrible. Woman, you see, is an object of such a kind that, study it as much as you will, it is always quite new."
"In that case, better not study them."
"Oh, no. Some mathematician has said pleasure lies not in discovering truth, but in seeking it."
Levin listened in silence. But in spite of all his efforts, he could not enter into his friend's soul and understand his feeling, nor the delight of studying women of that kind.
Chapter 15. The place where they were going to shoot was not far away, by a stream among young aspen trees. When they had reached the wood, Levin got down and led Oblonsky to the corner of a mossy and marshy glade, already free from snow. He himself went to a forked birch on the other side, and, leaning his gun against the fork of the lower branch, took off his coat, tightened his girdle, and tried whether he could move his arms freely. The old grey-haired Laska, following close on his heels, sat down warily in front of him and pricked up her ears. The sun was setting behind the forest, and the little birches interspersed among the aspen trees stood out clearly against the evening glow, with their drooping branches and their swollen buds ready to burst into leaf. From the thicket, where the snow had not all melted, the water still flowed in branching streamlets with a gentle rippling sound. Small birds chirped, and now and then flew from tree to tree. In the intervals of profound silence, last year's leaves were heard rustling, set in motion by the thawing of the earth and the growth of the grass. Just fancy. One can hear and see the grass growing, thought Lievin, as he noticed a wet, slate-coloured aspen leaf move close to the point of a blade of grass. He stood listening, and gazing down now on the wet mossy ground, now at the attentive Laska, now at the sea of bare treetops stretched out before him at the foot of the hill, and now at the darkening sky streaked with fleecy clouds. A hawk flew leisurely past, high above the distant forest. Another followed in the same direction and vanished. In the thicket, the birds chirped louder and louder and more eagerly. A tawny owl hooted nearby, and Laska started, took a few careful steps, and with her head on one side, again listened intently. A cuckoo called beyond the river. It called twice in its usual note, then hoarsely and hurriedly, and got out of time. "Fancy a cuckoo already," said Oblonsky, appearing from behind a bush. "Yes, I heard," answered Lievin, so reluctant to disturb the silence of the wood that his own voice sounded unpleasant to him. "They won't be long now." Oblonsky's figure again disappeared behind the bush, and Lievin saw the flare of a match, followed by the red glow of a cigarette and a spiral of blue smoke. Click, click. Oblonsky cocked his gun. "What's that screaming?" he asked, drawing Lievin's attention to a long-drawn cry like the high-pitched whinny of a colt in play. "Don't you know? It's a male hare. But stop talking! Listen, they're coming!" Lievin almost shouted, cocking his gun. They heard a shrill whistle in the distance, and after the 2 seconds interval so familiar to sportsmen, another followed, and then a third, and after the third whistle came a cry. Lievin looked to the right and to the left, and there before him, against the dull, light-blue sky, over the lower branches of the aspen tops, appeared the flying birds. They were flying straight toward him. The near sound of their cry, something like the sound made when tightly stretched cloth is steadily torn, seemed close to his ears. The long beak and neck of a bird were quite visible, and just as Lievin took aim, a red flash came from behind the bush where Oblonsky was standing, and the bird descended like an arrow and then fluttered up again. Another flash, followed by a report, and the bird, flapping its wings as if trying to keep up in the air, remained stationary for a moment, and then, with a heavy thud, fell on the swampy ground.
"Can I have missed?" cried Oblonsky, who could not see through the smoke. "Here it is," answered Lievin, pointing to Laska, who, with one ear erect, wagging her fluffy, high-arched tail, stepping slowly as if to prolong the pleasure, and seeming almost to smile, brought the dead bird to her master.
"Well, I'm glad you got it," said Lievin.
And while he spoke, he was already experiencing a feeling of envy at not having killed the bird himself.
"Wretched miss with the right barrel," replied Oblonsky, reloading. "Hush! Coming!"
Indeed, they heard two shrill whistles quickly following each other. Two snipe, playing and racing one another, whistling but not crying, flew almost over the sportsmen's heads. Then there were four reports. The birds took a swift turn like swallows and vanished from sight. The shooting was splendid. Oblonsky brought down two more birds, and Lievin brought down two, of which one was not recovered. It began to get dark. Through the young birches, Venus, bright and silvery, was already shining with her delicate glitter low down in the west, and high up in the east flickered the red fire of the dim Arcturus. Above his head, Lievin found, and again lost, stars of the Great Bear. The snipe had ceased flying, but Lievin decided to stay until Venus, which he could see underneath a branch, should rise above it, and all the stars of the Great Bear should be visible. Venus had risen above the branch, and the car of the Great Bear, as well as its shafts, showed clearly against the dark blue sky. But he still waited.
"Is it not time to go?" asked Oblonsky. It was quite quiet in the wood, not a bird stirred.
"Let's stay a little longer," answered Lievin.
"As you please." They were now standing some 15 yards apart.
"Stepan," said Lievin suddenly and unexpectedly,
"why don't you tell me whether your sister-in-law is married, or when she will be?"
Lievin felt so strong and calm that he thought the answer, whatever it might be, could not agitate him. But he did not at all expect the reply Oblonsky gave him.
"She has not thought, and is not thinking of getting married, but she is very ill, and the doctors have sent her abroad. They are even afraid for her life."
"You don't mean it!" exclaimed Lievin. "Very ill? What's the matter with her? How did she—"
While they were talking, Laska, pricking her ears, kept looking up at the sky, and then reproachfully at them. "What a time they have chosen to talk," thought she. "And there it comes flying. Just so. Here it is. They'll miss it." But at that moment, both men heard a shrill whistle that seemed to smite on their ears. They both seized their guns, and there were two flashes and two reports at the same moment. The woodcock that was flying high up instantly folded its wings and fell into the thicket, bending down the thin young shoots.
"That's good. It belongs to both," cried Lievin,
and ran into the thicket with Laska to look for the bird.
"Oh, but there was something unpleasant," he thought. "Yes, of course. Oh, Kitty is ill. Oh, but what can I do? I am very sorry," he thought. "Found? Good dog," he said,
taking the warm bird from Laska's mouth and putting it into his well-filled game bag.
"We've found it, Stepan," he shouted.
Chapter 16. On their way home, Lievin inquired the particulars of Kitty's illness and of the Shcherbatskys' plans, and though he would have been ashamed to confess it, what he heard was agreeable to him. It was agreeable because there was still hope for him, and even more because she was suffering, she who had made him suffer so much. But when Oblonsky began to speak of what caused Kitty's illness and to mention Vronsky's name, Lievin interrupted him. "I have no right whatever to know such family details, and frankly I am not interested in them either." Oblonsky gave a scarcely perceptible smile on noticing the quick change, so familiar to him, in Lievin's face, which became as gloomy as it had been bright a moment before. "Have you finally settled with Ryabinin about the forest?" asked Lievin.
"Yes, I have. I'm getting a splendid price for it. 38,000 rubles, 8 at once and the rest to be paid within 6 years. I've been bothering about it a long time. No one would give more."
"The fact is, you are giving the forest away," said Lievin moodily.
"Why giving away?" said Oblonsky with a good-natured smile, knowing well that everything would now seem wrong to Lievin.
"Because the forest is worth at least 500 rubles a desyatina," replied Lievin.
"Oh, you country gentleman," said Oblonsky jokingly, "and your tone of contempt for us poor townsfolk. But when it comes to getting business done, we do it better than anyone. Believe me, I have reckoned it all out," continued he, "and have sold the forest so well that I'm afraid he may change his mind. You know, it's not timber, but for the most part only fit for fuel," said he, hoping by this remark finally to convince Lievin of the injustice of his suspicions. "And it will not yield more than 10 sartsins of wood to the desyatina. And he's paying me at the rate of 200 rubles. Lievin smiled contemptuously.
"I know this manner," he thought, Not his only, but all townsmen's, who visit the country 2 or 3 times in 10 years, get hold of 2 or 3 expressions, use them in and out of season, and are firmly convinced they know everything. Timber and yield 10 satsans. He uses these words, but understands nothing about the business.
I should not try to teach you the things you scribble about at your office, he said, but in case of need would come to you for advice about them. But you are firmly convinced that you understand all this forest law. It's not easy. Have you counted the trees?
How can one count the trees? Said Oblonsky, still anxious to dispel his friend's ill humour.
Count grains of sand and planets' rays, e'en though a lofty mind were able.
Well, Ryabinin's lofty mind is able to do it.
And no dealer will ever buy without first counting, unless the forest is given to him for nothing, as you are doing.
I know your forest. I go shooting there every year, and it is worth 500 rubles at Izyatina, cash down, and he is paying you 200 on long term. That means that you have made him a present of about 30,000 rubles.
Oh, come, don't get so carried away, said Oblonsky piteously.
Why did no one offer more?
Because he and the other dealers are in league, and he has bought them off.
I've had dealings with them all, and I know them. They're not genuine dealers, but sharks. He would not consider a deal which would bring him in 10 or 15%. He waits till he can buy at a fifth of the value.
Oh, come. You are down in the dumps today.
Not at all, said Lievin gloomily, just as they drove up to the house.
At the porch stood a little cart, strongly bound with leather and iron, and to the cart was harnessed a well-fed horse with broad, tightly stretched straps. In the cart sat Ryabinin's clerk, who also performed a coachman's duties, his skin tightly stretched over his full-blooded face and his belt drawn tight. Ryabinin himself was already in the house and met the two friends in the hall. He was a tall, spare, middle-aged man with a moustache, a prominent shaven chin, and prominent, dim eyes. He wore a long-skirted blue coat with buttons very low down at the back, high boots drawn quite straight over the calves of his legs and crinkled round the ankles, and over them he had on a pair of large galoshes. He wiped his face all round with his handkerchief, and smoothing his coat, which was already quite in order, smilingly greeted the new arrivals. He held out his hand to Oblonsky as if he were trying to catch something.
"Oh, so you've come," said Oblonsky, taking his hand.
"That's right."
"I dared not disobey your excellency's commands, though the roads are quite too bad. I have literally had to walk all the way, but I have arrived in time."
"Konstantin Dmitrich, my respects to you," he said, turning to Lievin and trying to catch his hand too. But Lievin, frowning, pretended not to see the hand and began taking the snipe out of the game bag.
"You've been pleased to amuse yourself with shooting? What kind of bird may that be?" added Ryabinin, looking contemptuously at the snipe. "Something tasty?"
And he shook his head disapprovingly, as if much doubting whether this game were worth the candle.
"Would you like to go into my study?" said Lievin, frowning moodily and addressing Oblonsky in French. "Go into the study. You can talk things over there."
"That would do very well, or wherever you like," remarked Ryabinin with contemptuous dignity, as if to show them that though others might find it difficult to know how to behave with different people, yet for him no difficulty of any kind could ever exist. On entering the study, Ryabinin looked round by force of habit as though to find the icon, but after finding it he did not cross himself. He glanced at the book cupboards and bookshelves with the same look of doubt as he had bestowed on the snipe, smiled contemptuously, and again shook his head disapprovingly, decidedly refusing to admit that this game could be worth the candle.
"Well, have you brought the money?"
asked Oblonsky.
"Oh, take a seat."
"There won't be any difficulty about the money. I've come to see you and to talk matters over."
"Talk what matters over? But do take a seat."
"I can do that," said Ryabinin, sitting down and putting his arm on the back of his chair in a most uncomfortable way.
You must let me off something, Prince. You're wronging me. As to the money, it is all ready to the last kopeck. There'll be no delay about the money.
Lievin, who had been putting away his gun in a cupboard, was just going out of the door, but on hearing the dealer's words, he stopped.
As it is, you're getting the forest for next to nothing, he said. He came to me too late, else I would have fixed the price.
Ryabinin rose and smiled silently, surveying Lievin from his feet to his head.
He's very close, is Konstantin Dmitrich, he said, addressing Oblonsky with a smile. It's absolutely impossible to buy anything of him. I've been bargaining with him for wheat and offering a good price.
Why should I give you what is mine for nothing? I have not found it on the ground, nor stolen it.
Oh, dear, no, nowadays it is quite impossible to steal. Absolutely everything nowadays goes before a jury. Everything is judged honorably. There's no possibility of stealing.
Oh, we speak honestly. It's too much for the forest. There's no making any profit on it. I'm asking to have something knocked off, if only a trifle.
Well, have you settled the business or not? If you have, there's no use bargaining. But if not, said Lievin, I will buy the forest myself.
The smile vanished from Ryabinin's face, which assumed a hawk-like, rapacious and cruel expression. With his bony fingers he rapidly unfastened his coat, exposing his braided shirt, the brass buttons of his waistcoat, and a watch chain, and quickly took out a thick old pocketbook.
"If you please, the forest is mine," he said, rapidly crossing himself and holding out his hand. "Or take your money, the forest is mine." That's the way Ryabinin does business. No fussing about kopecks, he said, frowning and flourishing his pocketbook.
If I were you, I should not be in a hurry to take it, remarked Lievin.
What do you mean? Said Oblonsky with surprise. Why, I've given my word.
Lievin went out and slammed the door. Ryabinin looked at it and smiled, shaking his head.
That's all his youthfulness, his absolute childishness. Why, I am making this purchase, believe me, just for the honour and glory of the thing, so that it should be Ryabinin and not another that has bought Oblonsky's forest. But it's still a question whether, by God's mercy, I can make a profit, believe me, before God.
Please, sir, the agreement must be written.
An hour later, the dealer, with his coat well lapped over, the hooks of his overcoat carefully fastened, and with the agreement in his pocket, seated himself in his little cart and drove home.
"Oh, these gentlefolks," he remarked to his clerk while hooking up the leather apron of the cart. "Regular objects."
"But may I congratulate you on the purchase, Mikhail Ignatich?"
"Well, well."
Chapter 17. Oblonsky went upstairs, his pockets bulging with the treasury bills payable in 3 months' time with which Ryabinin had paid him. The forest transaction was completed, he had the money in his pocket, the shooting had been fine. Oblonsky was in the best of spirits, and therefore all the more anxious to dispel Lievin's ill humour. He wanted to finish the day at supper as pleasantly as he had begun it. Lievin really was in a bad humour, and in spite of his desire to behave kindly and amiably to his charming guest, he could not master himself. The intoxication of the news that Kitty was not married was beginning little by little to take effect on him. Kitty was unmarried and ill for love of the man who had slighted her. This insult seemed to fall upon him. Vronsky had slighted her, and she had slighted him, Lievin. Consequently, Vronsky had a right to despise him, and was therefore his enemy. But Lievin did not think all this. He dimly felt that there was something insulting to him in the affair, and was angry not with what had upset him, but with everything that presented itself to him. The stupid sale of the forest, the swindle Oblonsky had fallen a prey to, which had been perpetrated in his house, irritated him.
"Well, have you finished?"
he said when he met Oblonsky upstairs.
Will you have some supper?
I won't say no. What an appetite I get in the country. Wonderful. Why did you not offer Ryabinin something to eat?
Oh, let him go to the devil.
Well, really, how you treat him, said Oblonsky. You did not even give him your hand. Why not shake hands with him?
Because I do not shake hands with the footman, and the footman is 100 times better than he.
What a reactionary you really are. And what about merging the classes? Said Oblonsky.
Let those who like it merge to their heart's content, but it sickens me.
I see you are quite a reactionary.
I've really never considered what I am. I am Konstantin Levin, that's all.
And Konstantin Levin is in a very bad temper, said Oblonsky, smiling.
Yes, I am in a bad temper. And do you know why? Because, excuse me, of your stupid sale.
Oblonsky wrinkled his face good-naturedly like an innocent man who was being hurt and interfered with.
Oh, don't, he said. When has a man ever sold anything without being told immediately after that it was worth much more?
But while he's trying to sell, nobody offers him more. No, I see you have a grudge against that unfortunate Ryabinin.
Maybe I have.
Do you know why? You will again call me a reactionary or some other dreadful name. But all the same, it vexes and hurts me to see on all sides the impoverishment of the noblesse to which I too belong, and to which, in spite of the merging of the classes, I am very glad to belong. And impoverished, not from extravagance. That would not matter so much. To spend like a nobleman is their business. Only the noblesse know how to do it. At present, the peasants around here are buying land. That does not pain me. The squire does nothing. The peasant works and squeezes out the idler. That is as it should be, and I'm very glad on the peasant's account. But it hurts me to see this impoverishment as a result of, shall I call it, simplicity? Here a Polish leaseholder buys for half its value the splendid estate of a lady who lives in Nice. There land that is worth 10 rubles a desiatina is leased to a merchant for 1 ruble. And now you, without any reason, have presented that scamp with 30,000 rubles. Then what do you want? Is one to count every tree? Certainly count them.
You have not counted them, but Ryabinin has. Ryabinin's children will have the means to live and get an education, while yours may not have.
Well, forgive me, but there's something petty in all this counting. We have our occupation and they have theirs, and they have to make a profit.
Anyway, the thing is done, and there's an end to it. And here come the fried eggs, just the way I like them best. And Argathia Mikhailovna will give us some of that excellent herb brandy.
Oblonsky sat down to table and began joking with Agathia Mikhailovna, assuring her that it was long since he had had such a dinner and supper as that day.
"Well, you appreciate it at least," said Agathia Mikhailovna. "But Konstantin Dmitrich, whatever one gives him, if it were only a crust of bread, would just eat it and go away."
Try as Levin would to control himself, he remained morose and silent. There was one question he wanted to put to Oblonsky, but could not bring himself to ask, nor could he find the form to put it in, or the moment to ask it. When Oblonsky had gone down to his room, and after again washing, had put on his frilled nightshirt and got into bed, Levin still lingered in his room, talking about various trifles, and unable to ask what he wanted to know.
"What wonderful soap they make!" he said, examining and unwrapping a cake of scented soap Agathia Mikhailovna had prepared for the visitor, but which Oblonsky had not used.
"Just look. It is quite a work of art."
"Yes, yes, there are all sorts of improvements in everything now,"
said Oblonsky, with a moist and beautiful yawn.
"In the theatres, for instance,
and all places of amusement. Oh, oh."
He yawned.
"Electric light everywhere."
"Oh, oh."
"Yes, electric light," said Levin.
"Yes. By the by,
"Where is Vronsky now?" he asked, suddenly putting down the soap. "Vronsky?" said Oblonsky, ceasing to yawn. "He is in Petersburg. He left soon after you did and has not been in Moscow once since then. And, you know, Konstantin, I will tell you quite frankly," he said, leaning his elbow on the table by his bed and supporting on his hand his good-looking, rosy face with its glittering, kind and sleepy eyes. "It was your own fault. You were frightened of a rival. But as I told you then, I do not know who had the better chance. Why did you not make a dash for it? I told you at the time that..." He yawned, but only with his jaw, without opening his mouth. "Does he or does he not know that I proposed?" thought Lievin, looking at him. "Yes, there is something sly and diplomatic in his face." And feeling himself blush, he gazed in silence straight into Oblonsky's eyes. "If there was anything on her side at that time, it was only the external attraction," continued Oblonsky. "You know, his being a perfect aristocrat and his future position in society had an effect not on her, but on her mother." Lievin frowned. The insult of the refusal he had had to face burned in his heart like a fresh, newly received wound. But he was at home, and the walls of home are helpful. "Wait, wait," he began, interrupting Oblonsky. "You talk of his being an aristocrat, but I should like to ask you what is Vronsky's or anyone else's aristocracy that I should be slighted because of it. You consider Vronsky an aristocrat? I don't. A man whose father crawled up from nothing by intrigues and whose mother has had relations with heaven knows whom. No, pardon me, I consider myself and people like me aristocrats. People who can point back to three or four honourable generations of their family, all with a high standard of education, talent and intelligence are a different matter, who have never cringed before anyone, never depended on anyone, but have lived as my father and my grandfather did. I know many such. You consider it mean for me to count the trees in my wood while you give Ryabinin 30,000 rubles, but you will receive a government grant, and I don't know what other rewards, and I shan't, so I value what is mine by birth and labour. We, and not those who only manage to exist by the bounty of the mighty of this world and who can be bought for a piece of silver, are the aristocrats. But whom are you driving at? I agree with you," said Oblonsky, sincerely and cheerfully, though he felt that Lievin ranked him with those who could be bought for silver. Lievin's vehemence sincerely pleased him. "Whom are you driving at? Though much of what you say is not true of Vronsky, I'm not speaking about that. I want to tell you candidly that if I were you, I'd come to Moscow now with me and..." "No. I don't know if you knew it or not, and I don't care, but I will tell you. I proposed and was refused, and your sister-in-law, Katerina Alexandrovna, is now only a painful and humiliating memory to me."
"Why? What nonsense!
But don't let us talk about it. Forgive me, please, if I have been rude to you," said Lievin. Now that he had spoken out, he became once more as he had been in the morning.
"You're not angry with me, Stiva? Please, don't be angry," he said, smiling, and took his hand.
"Oh, no, not at all. There was nothing to be angry about. I'm glad we've had this explanation. And, you know, the shooting in the early morning is often very good. Shall we not go? I would not sleep again after it, but go straight from there to the station."
A capital